Hello, friends, and welcome to episode number 102 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today's guest is quite an amazing one. I will introduce in just a moment. This episode is brought to you by Audible, the leading provider of audiobooks. Big Web Show listeners can download a free ebook on Audible and get an extended free trial of the service by going to audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. That's audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. And I'll have a lot more to say about that a little later in the show. But first, I have the most to say about our guest. He's a designer, an author, and speaker living in Salem, Massachusetts. Bachelor number one is the co-founder of Dribble, a community for designers. The founder of Simple Bits, a tiny design studio. A longtime advocate of standards-based web design, who has worked with YouTube, Microsoft, Google, MTV, ESPN, and others. He has written several really amazing books about web design and standards-based web design. He's an aspiring claw hammer banjoist, sports a beard, wears a baseball cap, and recently received a Tech Fellow Award. In fact, in early 2012, he received the Tech Fellow Award. So the Tech Fellow Award, that's from TechCrunch? What is that? What is that, Dan? Dan Cederholm. Yeah. Dan hey. Simplebit Cederholm. Welcome to our show. Hello, Dan.
Thank you so much. That was an amazing intro. And thanks for having me, man. Thanks for having me back again.
Well, you're an amazing guy. You're an amazing
always,
guy.
Wow, you're too kind. Yeah,
they said call you a
guest.
Guru.
Like, well, who's the amazing guest? Is there like a third person you're going to tell me about here?
Yeah, modest.
No, thank you.
It says you're a guru, web standards guru. I am looking at a photo of you getting money and an award on stage with a bunch of nerds. There's Jim Parsons.
Yes. From that the was Big the Bang. Best part of the whole thing.
And you're standing right next to him, looking confident and handsome.
Thank you.
And the words behind you, it says, Dan Cederholm, web standards guru and co-founder, Dribble.
Whoa. Yeah. Jim Parsons from Big Bang Theory was the host of this awards thing. It was in San Francisco. And the Tech Fellow group is it's kind of like a consortium of people that have a lot of money and have done things in the web world and what's cool about it though is that the prize is to take a reasonable size of money to invest in a startup of your choice.
So it wasn't money for you to go buy a new car.
Right, exactly. No, you don't actually get it in your pocket. You can assign it to a company that you think you care about or you want to invest in, and it happens every year. And I think they've done it three or four years now, and which I think is cool. I think it's an interesting award because. Hopefully, I think their idea is that it's going to fuel some other companies. You know, by saying, all right, let's find some interesting people that are doing interesting things, and let's give them a little bit of money to find out what they think is interesting, and hopefully help that cause. After a while, the timing was perfect, and I actually ended up investing in editorially,
So you don't invest in your own company.
Right. I mean, I guess you could. I think some people have, but in the way that this fund is set up, I believe, and this is all like this kind of stuff. I have no idea how this stuff works, like investment in it. But the investment in the company is part of a large, like all the winners of the year it's like one fund. So all the winners sort of own a very tiny percentage of whatever you're investing in the company. So I don't think it makes sense to invest in your own company if you're the owner of the company, and then you're almost sort of giving away some of your but I think that has helped in certain circumstances, like if you were starting a company and from the ground up and you needed some funds to get going, that could help immensely.
But now Are these all publicly traded companies? They're not, right? I mean, editorially. No. So how do you invest in something that's private?
Yeah, I mean, well, that came about just talking to the founders like Mandy and Jason and I think I knew they were looking for funding, and I just, hey, well, I've got this thing that I just, you know, that I just want. I don't even really understand how this works, but I'll just give you guys the money, and you know, you can help you get off the ground, and that's what happened.
They bought a big pool table with it, a solid gold pool table.
Yeah. Well, that was
sad.
That was the stipulation. I said, if you're gonna do anything, do the solid gold.
Jason Samaria bought himself gold shoes, is what I heard.
Yeah, after I saw them, they were very well dressed. The next time I saw them, yeah, extremely well dressed.
No, this is great. And other people were like Wilson Miner.
Yes, Wilson Miner was there. The GitHub founder, Tom Preston Warner. I'm forgetting a Craig Maud. Greg Maud, yeah, who I met for the first time there, and he's a fantastic guy, super talented,
yeah,
super smart. So yeah, it was cool. It was an honor to go, and like I said before, like seeing Jim Parsons in person, like presenting, is kind of awesome. In fact, the funniest thing about I think him is that he mentioned that on the show, he's like the biggest geek and knows everything about everything, and like he doesn't. He said before the show he'd never watched Star Trek before. You know, is not really a geek. Maybe a geek in other ways, but not necessarily the one he's on the show.
So he's an actor. He's really an actor. Like,
yeah, right. So it was shocking that he was not the real person, Sheldon. You
know? Yeah, I hear most of the Star Trek actors from the original cast like hated Star Trek. I mean, they're stuck with it, but they thought it was a stupid show, which is
it was horrible.
Yeah. So they're not fans themselves, which is just right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's kind of sad. Well, that's cool. Understandable.
Was that the first award you've won?
It was first real award. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. Actually, there was there's been a couple little things. The first thing in this web world was the Weblog Awards, which I don't even know if that still happens, but it was at South by Southwest every year.
For oh, Nikolai.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Nikolai. I don't know if he still runs it. Hopefully. But it was the first year I went to South by Southwest, so it was pretty amazing.
That's a nice way to start your...
Yeah, it was great. I mean, that trip was amazing in a lot of ways, but so that was for Simple Bits.
Which was a blog at the time. And,
yeah, totally. That's all it was. Exactly.
Well, were you freelancing at that time?
Let's see. Yeah, no, actually, I was working at Fast Company magazine at that point. But just ending that because they moved to New York, and you could either move to New York or get laid off, and I chose to do that. And then
you love Salem.
Cause it's home. New England is home, and I didn't want to. I mean, I loved New York, but at the time it wasn't right. Yeah.
How did you get so good at CSS? Many people want to know.
Ooh, wow.
And leave aside the false humility. Just assume for the sake of argument that you're actually good at CSS.
Okay.
How did you teach yourself?
My first reaction was going to be, I'm not good at it anymore. But back in the day, though, I mean, just a lot of time and being really excited about what was happening. And, you know, I mean, you kicked it all off with to hell with bad browsers. And I remember, you know, so like a lot of
people. The kids today don't know that.
No, well, maybe I have to explain what that was.
You're right.
Seminal List Apart article.
Whatever. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I didn't want to do that.
So
you started doing CSS in like 2001, 2002.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like everybody else, like a lot of people were building stuff with tables, and that's just the way you had to do it, and because of browsers and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the CSS, just seeing like how much easier it was to use CSS and how much more natural it seemed, aside from the browser things that we had to deal with. But I just got really excited about it. And I had, I think, a couple of things. I was excited about it, and I had a lot of time, which I don't have. Right.
Right.
So when like
You didn't own a company. You didn't have ESPN and Microsoft as clients. You were
Exactly. I had a lot. I had like a pretty steady job. You know, at Fast Company, which I'd go in and be able to do stuff with. Didn't have kids. I didn't. You know, I could stay up late and
heyday of blogging.
And blogging, yeah, exactly. Just like blogging, reading blogs. You know, that's the way we all communicated really back then.
Do you miss that?
I do. I think I missed the pace of that because it was a lot. I don't know. It was a lot easier to have a false sense of I have a handle on what's going on right now. You know, it's not moving at such a rapid pace where you're sort of overwhelmed. It's like, oh, okay, well, I read a blog post last week, and now I can sort of I can take that what this person was talking about, and I can formulate my own opinion about it and experiment. And whereas now I think things move so quickly, it's hard to know like what the right thing to do is. And I think that's what web design is, right? Like trying to convince yourself that you're actually doing the right thing when really there's probably no right way to do it. One right way.
Well, now it's 1,000 people shouting at you on Twitter instead of five bloggers that you like occasionally writing a piece that you think about.
Yeah, exactly.
When you started blogging, when you started doing Simple Quiz, it wasn't when you first started blogging, but I felt like you really started coming into your own in a big way when you started Simple Quiz. It was like you just said, you would do things like, I want to make a navigation item. How shall I mark that up? How shall I write the code? Or I want to move something to the left. How shall I do that? And there was a lot of sort of semantic markup teaching in what you were doing. I wondered if you were being a pedagogue. Yeah. I wondered if you were just a very smart teacher who already knew the answer, or if in part you were asking yourself the question, I'm not sure on some of these things what the best answer is.
Right.
But that I think made you great at CSS and HTML. Right. The fact that you made that interesting and involved everyone and had such a simple, deceptively simple way of doing it. It was almost like a lesson plan every day.
Oh, thanks, man. I think the answer is like both of those things. So I on some of the questions I had no idea, and I was like, well, you know, I should just ask. Let's get a crowdsourced opinion about what the best way to mark up like a conversation or something, you know, and I don't know myself. I don't know. And so in a lot of the cases, there was no one answer either. And it was more about like the discussion afterward about people taking sides and trying to explain like, well, this is why I think semantically this is the best way to mark up this certain thing. And then other ones, other ones that were easy. And I would ask, you know, like you said, knowing what the answer is really, but seeing how people reacted to that was interesting. And then, of course, you know that people are just getting into this thing, and it's valuable for them to learn. And that's how I learned, right? I learned by reading, you know, stuff on a list apart and Ask Dr. Webb and all that, like Web Monkey.
You know who doesn't get enough credit? Mark Newhouse.
Oh man, totally.
Mark Newhouse.
Absolutely.
One of the most important things he wrote was Taming Lists.
Taming Lists, exactly. That was huge.
Which, for those who haven't read it, he was the first person, I don't think he was the first, necessarily the only person in the world who ever thought of this, but he was the first person I know who articulated very clearly that if you wanted to make navigation, that there was a semantic way to do navigation.
Yes.
Up until that point, even if you were trying to use CSS, you'd be like typing like item one break tag, item two break tag, item three, and wondering why CSS sucked. I'm typing all these words in break tags, and CSS doesn't know what to do with them. CSS sucks. And he just said, well, you know, is it a list? Perhaps it's a list. Maybe that's what a list is supposed to be. And then he showed like five or six really nifty.
Yeah.
I mean, they were nice little nav treatments. They were sort of, I don't know. I thought that was just so.
I agree. I mean, that was a watershed article right there, naming lists. I mean, it really, he's talking about lists, but it really made you think of other bits of markup too.
It seemed like your first book came out of that in a way.
Definitely. Yep.
When you teach and when you write, when I teach and write, it's so I know what I figure out what I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I love imparting knowledge, but I wouldn't know what I think otherwise.
Yeah.
When you wrote SaaS for Designers, your new book, which comes out in November, November is tomorrow. I think your book comes out in a few days. It doesn't come out November 1st, but,
right.
Did you write SaaS for Web Designers so you could overcome your own fear of SaaS? Or so you could learn SaaS? I mean, why did you write the book?
A little bit of both of those. I think mostly it was that I was so reluctant to it for a long time. And when I finally came around to that, I figured there was a lot of other people like me that had been doing CSS for a long time or were sort of, you know, comfortable in the way that they were writing CSS and protective of the output of CSS as like a craft, you know, whatever.
Right, because it is.
It is. It totally is. And that's the way we learn. Like, you know, we learn by viewing source. It's kind of an interesting – a front-end developer designer is an interesting piece of the web puzzle in that what we do is visible and people can pick it apart very easily by viewing source. And I always thought that was a wonderful way of learning by looking at other people's code. And so because of that, I was always really protective of how the code even looked or was formatted or organized, right?
I had the privilege of working with you, collaborating with you on a few projects. And you're not only a great developer, you're a great designer. And so for that reason, too, you were really particular just about the way you optimized your CSS, the way you organized it, the way you arranged it on the page. I always felt like a shabby workman when I'd look at my own CSS and I'd be like, even just things like I didn't bother indenting this one thing. And it'd be like, like you really looked at it like, you know, you were just with a chisel, like you were just not leaving any rough edges and everything. And so. I used to love looking at your looking at your code, and I thought, how is this guy, who makes such artistic CSS, going to adapt to a preprocessor that says, "Well, this is what CSS looks like."
Exactly.
Wasn't that a big hurdle?
That was absolutely a big hurdle. That was probably the biggest hurdle, and it was actually prevented me from diving into SaaS head on for a long time,
like a year.
Like a year, exactly. Working on Dribbble with Rich Thornett is the co-founder. He's the smart end of this operation. And, Rails has always had a really good SAS implementation, and it makes it really easy to use SAS and automatically compile it for you and output it and everything. And so he also understood a lot of the benefits to SAS in terms of not repeating yourself in a lot of programming concepts.
Which is the same as Ruby, right?
exactly. Right.
Prefer convention over configuration, I think is the...
Right.
Right.
Totally.
So basically the idea with Ruby on Rails is don't reinvent the wheel. If something already exists, if something's been coded, use that. Don't, you know, because in the old days we used to have to do everything from scratch.
Everything from scratch, exactly. Everything by hand, yeah.
Do you know where SAS came from? I don't. I don't know who created it or.
So, it was created by Hampton Caitlin and Nathan Weisenbaum. And, they crafted SAS along with Haml, which is another sort of an HTML version of SAS in a way, like a shorthand HTML language, which I don't use and I don't really subscribe to that. But and that, I don't think that's really taken off. It certainly hasn't taken off as well as SaaS has. I think with SaaS, the amount of shortcuts and making it easier to do things in CSS, the win was so strong, and eventually I realized that. And I also realized that, you know, so I, going back to the protecting your source code kind of thing, and that was the reason why. And Rich would be like, you know, let's just try it. You know, it's going to make things easier. And finally I caved and used it. So I owe a lot to Rich actually for sort of being relentless with me on this. But I realized, you know, a couple things changed. Like one thing that's changed about viewing source is that we use we don't just use view source anymore. There's better tools for looking at code built into the browser, like so the web inspector. That's become invaluable, and that's probably a way that most people pull apart existing websites that they don't have the code for, right? Looking at the web inspector. I started to realize it doesn't the formatting of your code, the output, it doesn't matter as much as it did maybe 10 years ago. And that the wins that SaaS would give me as a you know, managing a big site with a lot of styles, that it's a much better win. And we decided to go that route.
What does SAS, for people who don't know what it does, what does SAS do? It's a CSS preprocessor. What does that mean?
Yeah.
What does it do for you?
So it basically allows you to do a lot of things that you don't normally or can't normally do in CSS. So a couple really quick examples. Like one is variables, which anybody that writes CSS can relate to. And understand pretty quickly the benefit of that. And that being like, even just for colors, basically, you know, often used bits of values in your CSS file, like being able to change those in one place and not have to, you know, go through the entire document to change that. That's huge.
So if there's a particular shade of blue that occurs 15 times in my design.
Right.
And I'm going to want to change it to a shade of pink.
Exactly. Then
change it in one place.
Change it in one place, and it'll automatically reformat everything.
Almost seems like CSS for CSS.
Yeah, in a way it is. Exactly. And more so with something called mix-ins, which are basically like reusable rule sets that you can use throughout your CSS. So stuff that's used often. And for me, at the time when I finally embraced this stuff, the CSS3 vendor prefix stacks that we had to repeat everywhere for stuff like rounded corners or box shadows or transitions or gradients is a big one. That's like the syntax for that is kind of really ugly to support all the browsers. Write that stuff once and then as a mix in and then be able to call that from the style sheet whenever you need to. That's hugely valuable. And as those specifications change, you can change the mix in file once and then, you know, it's going to update everything. Things like that are, you know, this is like really, really super valuable. And hopefully, I mean, some of this stuff might get folded back into CSS, like variables, for instance, are being tossed around. And I think actually implemented in maybe Safari or some browsers.
How does that work?
Well, the syntax is a little different, and it's actually a little weirder than SAS. SAS is just simple, like it's a dollar sign to define a variable, and then that's it. There is a variable proposal. It's, you know, the W3C is working on that. That's implemented in Safari, I believe. And the syntax is a little different, but the concept is the same. Because, you know, people realize this is kind of important stuff to have. This is stuff we need to be able to work like efficiently. And SAS, I think, is interesting in that it can be somewhat of a sandbox for stuff that might be appropriate to fold back into the spec. I understand, like, you know, doing some research on this stuff, like, I understand the original concept of CSS was supposed to be simple. Like, it wasn't supposed to be like programming language, or because they wanted a lot of people to use it, and not right. just developers and programmers, but they wanted people, as many people as possible, to be able to use it. And hence the simplicity of it, I guess you could say.
It's
and
Bert Bowes design principles article.
Exactly. Bert Bowes, exactly. And so, and I can understand. I get that. That's important, right? The web is not, it's bigger than just creating web applications for businesses, right? The web is about, you know, sharing content to as many people as possible and getting information out there. And at the same time, when you are doing something complex like a web application or whatever, and you have a large style sheet, it's difficult. I mean, it's not easy. It's CSS has its quirks that annoy us all. And so SAS is just, you know, it's a nice way of adding this layer that sort of turbocharges your syntax and gives you some stuff that's just not available otherwise.
Do you build stuff faster now? Is there any way of measuring that?
Yeah. I mean, definitely faster, because a lot of the stuff, you know, for instance, mix-ins or there are a lot of things that make responsive design easier with SAS.
In terms of
media queries, you know, so with media queries, you can, in SAS, you can nest the media query within the rule set that you're dealing with, and it'll actually, when it compiles, it'll bubble that out into the proper place. And so it keeps stuff that you're doing responsively, depending on a media query, in the same area rather than like a separate file somewhere else. And so keeping it in context really is helpful for a lot of projects, I think. But a lot of the stuff is reusable in terms of, you know, the stuff I was talking about earlier about mix-ins, like CSS3 stacks, and those things can be reusable. And I have a mix-ins file, for instance, that I can use on any project. So I only have to write those once, not just once for the project, but once in general, and include that in any project that I start, and boom, I'm off to the races in terms of just being able to write one line to add a box shadow to something, and know that I can plug in values to that.
So
it's really time saving.
It's a platform in a way.
In a way it is. Yeah. I mean, the nice thing is that it does spit out. See, obviously in the end, it does spit out CSS, real CSS. It has to, right, for the browser.
Right.
So you can, you know, the one of the downsides is you rely on it, and
have you started forgetting yes. how to code the way are you not learning some new CSS3 things because you use a mix-in to take care of it for you?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, that you someone coming into this learning this all new, that could happen to them, right? I mean, there are a lot of
like someone using a platform. An advanced coder uses a platform and knows what their own sense of best practices are, and knows but someone who's new thinks that everything in that platform is a best practice, or they never learned why a certain thing was done. They could, it's documented, but they don't.
Yep.
And it just becomes like using a WYSIWYG tool in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a danger, right? Like using a framework, like,
right.
That's why I always say, like, you know, check frameworks out for learning purposes, but, you know, don't rely on them, because what you just said, you start taking things for granted, so that when that framework's not there or it changes or whatever, and then you're suddenly in the dark about what's actually happening.
So is SAS good for you who knows CSS pretty well, but bad for someone, since SAS isn't in a way a framework? Is it, by that same logic, bad for someone who doesn't know CSS? What do you think?
I think it's good for both, because and this is one of the misconceptions that I hopefully clear up in the book, right? I think that one of the misconceptions is that SAS writes bad code, or you need to learn like Ruby programming, or you need to be a developer to actually use it. And fortunately, that's not true. You could use as much SaaS or as little SaaS as you want, and still take advantage of it. Like you could use just variables, and that would help you out, and that would be something that takes 2 minutes to understand how it works, and yet not disrupt the flow of your normal CSS authoring.
You could just type a dollar sign to start with, and
yeah, exactly. Yep. Because you know, SCSS, which is the syntax that we use in the book, is valid CSS. So literally renaming your CSS file to .scss, you're using SAS already, okay? And then you can convert an existing style sheet that way, and that's just like, start slowly folding in things. And that's what we did with Dribbble. Dribbble was not written with SAS initially. It was this is large file. We changed the file name and then just started slow. I started slowly working, and still am actually slowly working in SAS to the style sheet. And it doesn't need to happen overnight. You don't need to learn all of SAS before you start using SAS, which is nice. You can use one part of it at a time and then fold that in, and that's going to make that part of your life easier. And then, you know, as you learn more, you can convert more to SASify it. But
so it's sort of like when you're scared of HTML5, just change the doc type.
Yeah, exactly.
Just change the doc type.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Done that. Nothing happened. The universe didn't break. Now, see. Now try article.
Yep.
Just try that element, or try the video element. Afraid of everything else, just try the video element. Keep using a div, but use the video element. See what happens.
Exactly.
Right.
They're both going to work. They're both going to work in tandem together. Exactly. Same thing. Same exact thing.
Well, you make a persuasive case, and you're a good teacher, and we're going to keep talking about SAS and lots of other stuff, but at this point, we have to thank our sponsors again, so here we go. The Big Web Show is sponsored in part by Audible, the leading provider of downloadable audiobooks, and we have a special offer exclusively for Big Web Show listeners. Audible offers 100,000 books covering virtually every genre. If you want to listen to a book, Audible has it. Listen to audiobooks anytime, anywhere, including iPhones, iPads, computers, Kindles, you name it. Here's the best part. Audible is offering Big Web Show listeners a free audiobook plus a 30-day trial. Go to audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow to take advantage of this special offer. Doing so, you'll not only get the chance to check out a great service, you'll support our show as well. Here's a big book Big Web Show listeners might like, Outliers, The Story of Success by Malcolm Gladwell, narrated by Malcolm Gladwell. It's practically like having Malcolm Gladwell in your house reading to you.
Awesome.
Or in your bed reading to you, if you prefer. Once again, get your free audiobook and kick off your free trial at audiblepodcast.com/bigwebshow. But wait, there's more. This episode is also brought to you by our friends at Igloo Software. Now, Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. Big Web Show listeners should go to igloosoftware.com/big so Igloo knows I sent you. Igloo's cool. You can share content quickly with built-in apps, blogs, calendars, file sharing, forums, Twitter-like microblogs, and wikis. Did I say that well? Microblogs and wikis.
Yeah, perfect.
Everything is social. You can comment on any kind of content, at mention your coworkers, follow content for updates, and use tags to group things around the way you work. You can add on rooms like mini igloos for each of your teams to work in. It's easy. Everything's drag and drop. It's all responsive design, and it uses beautiful fonts from Typekit. Right, I'm going to say that part again. It's drag and drop, features responsive design, and uses beautiful fonts from Typekit. Okay? Igloo has enterprise-grade security, and you can start using it right away. And it's free to use with up to 10 people. And when your Igloo grows, it's only $12 per person each month. So if nothing else, just check out the website to see their funny videos about the service. When you support Igloo, you support the Big Web Show and Mule Radio, who brings you such fantastic programming as Issues, where New York designer Mike Essel and San Francisco designer Ed Casey talk about comic books. So go to igloosoftware.com/big to start building your Igloo. I mean it. That's igloosoftware.com/big. And now back to Dan Cederholm.
Yay.
Where are you from originally? I forget.
I grew up in Vermont. And
Ethan McConnell and you both grew up in Vermont, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely
what
true.
What is in
true
the water?
Story. I know. What isn't in the water, maybe?
Maybe what isn't in the water. Yeah.
A lot of fresh air and cows and good cheese.
Cold.
Very cold.
It's kind
of a lot of snow. Totally.
Oslo.
Like Oslo, exactly. Yeah. Not quite as extreme as Oslo, actually. But and not as dark. It gets dark up there, right? In the winter. Like dark all day, I think. But yeah, I grew up in Vermont and then moved to Needham, Massachusetts when I was in high school, just outside Boston.
And moved to Needham?
Yeah. Yep. Whole family moved. And
changing in high school is rough.
Oh, man, that was rough time. It was like midway through freshman year. So like, I don't think there could be a worse time, actually.
No. No.
Do that.
It was awful. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Were you in the glee club?
No, I was worse. I was like in the marching band, and that doesn't help when you're moved to a new town, you know?
Oh my.
I mean, I'm not ashamed of it, I guess, but.
No. So what, you play saxophone?
I played drums.
Nice.
Yeah, I played drums. I played snare drum and in the marching band, and that was cool. And then,
have you ever seen Mr. B Natural, the Mystery Science Theater 3000?
No, I have not seen that. I mean, I love that show, but I have not seen that
so
one.
So you remember that show, right? The robots and the guy are like wisecracking, watching terrible old movies. And they, when the movie was too short or they had to cut some of it out for whatever reason, maybe censorship, they would start with a bizarre old short. And this one was Mr. B Natural is kind of like Mary Martin, Peter Pan. It's like a woman dressed in tights, pretending to be a man for whatever reason, who's changing the life of a nerdy teenage boy who isn't popular by getting him to join the band, the marching band, because that is the key to popularity, as we know, know.
Absolutely. In America, that's the way you become popular.
So if you Google YouTube, Mr. B Natural, Mr. Science, MST3K, and it's well worth watching.
All right, I'm very, putting that down.
Very enjoyable.
I'm writing this down.
You're also the co-founder of Dribbble. Which is like it's been going for 3 years now.
Yeah, it has been. A little over 3 years, I think.
And how many members now?
Members approaching 500,000 members, which that includes everybody that's either just people that want to follow. The designer pool, people that are uploading and sharing, is actually still small. It's like just over 50,000 now.
And the quality is very high.
The quality is very high, yeah. And that's because, you know, we have this invite process still. We have had since the beginning. And in the beginning, that was to make sure that we could handle it as a two-person operation that also had full-time jobs. And,
right.
But over time, it's also, people have coveted the invitations, and that's sort of affected how the community grows. And we let the community grow itself by giving out invitations and having people invite, people they know and everything.
It's network effect.
It's network effect. I think, the downside is that it looks like we're intentionally keeping people out, which is not.
Are you still
not
getting that? That can't be. You can't still.
Oh,
be
we
doing
do.
That.
You'd be surprised.
You'd still. Surprised. I mean, I could see when you started, like people mistaking it for that. But it's 3 years. It's huge.
Yeah, 3 years. Yeah.
Are there just people who can't get in and are angry? Is that the problem?
Yeah, I think so. Not necessarily. I think there's enough invitations out there where people that really want to get in can find a way, but we do want to open it up more to, if you want to be in there, you shouldn't have to. We don't want to make it difficult. We want to make it inclusive, and but that's a challenge because the way the community has been built over the last 3 years has been by invitation. So
we have some work changing it now.
Yeah, it would be a big. We can't just tomorrow just open it up and have hundreds of thousands of people uploading stuff, and that would be create some support, obviously scaling and all that. So we got to do it gradually and carefully. But I think as long as we don't disrupt the your experience, current experience on Dribbble, and make that better, you know, like by offering you stuff to follow that you're interested in and not see the stuff that you're not interested in. I think,
well, how would you do that? I mean, are there, do you have algorithms now where if I liked Martin Oberhauser and Artua Design Agency, then I'll probably also like the work of Focus Lab? I mean, can you do stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that would be cool to do, exactly. Like, just sort of almost like work curating suggestions for you. We do have a suggestions section, which is basically stuff that people you follow have liked, but by people that you aren't following yet. So a way of discovering like people you might not know about, but you're the people that you do like. So it's sort of like what you said, actually, a little bit. But we need, like, that kind of stuff we would want to do more of. And so that, you know, if you're interested in icon design but not illustration or vice versa.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Not like, suggesting your friends, yeah. Your friends with Leah Veroux, and she's also right. Friends with Chris Coyer, so maybe you want to follow Chris Coyer. Not like that. Mm-hmm. Not like that.
Right, right. Because I don't think that works for Twitter, you know, but right. Not necessarily for like visual design.
This
work.
Is more like this yeah. Person has this sort of eclectic 1950s handmade feel to their thing. I'd like to see more people who do that.
Yeah, or exactly.
Or this looks very hand drawn and beautiful, or this looks deliberately naive. I'd like to see more deliberately naive things. I mean, are people's tags, do you ever find people being deceptive with their tagging to try to get, is anyone trying to game, like just trying to get more viewers and they don't really care? Have you found anybody doing that stuff?
Oh yeah, definitely. There's a lot of people trying to game the system. And fortunately we have, you know, a person, Sam Fine, is our community manager. He's sort of on top of that. Our nickname for him in-house is Sam Justice. So like he's just like nice. He's on top of this stuff, you know, like, I mean, people try to do that. I think the tags, when the thing about tags is that's interesting is that when they're done well, they're great, right? And then when they're not done well, they're kind of harmful in a way. Like they're just noise. And we have not put in like certain categories that you like pre-built categories you could put stuff in. But that, you know, maybe that's something we do. I don't know. Later on, where you can put it into buckets like icon design, illustration, or UI, or whatever.
I'm and really liking the way, because originally it was mostly pure graphic design, right?
Yeah.
Just like,
yeah.
Yep. What do you think this looks like? And now, like, here's the hockey puck. I'm looking right now at Creative Dash's hockey puck menu concept. I don't know if you've seen that. Nice. But it's like people are sharing interactive things and demos of interacting things, and that takes this to a new level and makes it really, really web design.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, totally. I think they're pushing that envelope in terms of what you can share through this small window as a springboard to some other concept, like you're just saying, like interactive stuff. People are using animated GIFs to show interaction, which I think is really interesting. Sort of a hack way around like the fact that it's a static image, but you want to show more because it's a UI element. We love that stuff. I think, you know, just sort of watching how people are using it and then reacting to that and trying to make that experience as best as possible based on what the people are doing. That's been our goal, like since we started it. And, you know, hopefully it's not a knee jerk reaction thing where we're just listening to any suggestion, but more like just seeing it as a whole and seeing how people are using it and what trends are happening so that we can, in terms of features, so that we can build stuff around that fosters more of it.
I get so much pleasure from looking at this every day.
Oh, awesome.
And I think,
man.
I know a lot of people do, right?
It's fun. It's fun.
Right. So if you have 500,000 members, but you have 50,000 real contributors, that means there's 450,000 people who come here just to soak up design. Just like, right?
That's right. Grab a cup of coffee in the morning and see what people are up to.
Start to feel inspired.
Yeah, get inspired, find people to follow and find people to even hire, you know. There's certainly a lot of different ways to use it. And I think, it's fun. And
now,
I think
that for you, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
What, so from, there's that, that's the sort of the user's perspective, but I'm curious for you, as co-owner, what business, changes have come recently? What things you're doing differently now, or partnerships you may have fomented, or opportunities you may have pursued, things you've changed, you know, for your benefit and the community's benefit? Are there things like that you want to talk about?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the biggest things is over the last year that we've added team members. So, you know, for a long time, it was just Rich and I running this thing. And we slowly, you know, worked up to we're working full time on it together. And then we've added now three other members. So we're up to five plus a sixth person as a writer. So
when did you get the writer?
About a couple months ago. And it's actually Susanna Baird, which is Rich, the co-founder's wife, who's actually a fantastic writer. I mean, she's just like that's what she does. And she's been doing a lot of pieces for us, you know, a thing called Spaced, which is on interesting workspaces for Dribbble members.
Where would I find that?
This is all on the blog, actually, on the Dribbble blog, so blog.dribbble.com. And then she also does a weekly replay, which is kind of like a weekly wrap-up of just interesting stuff that's been on Dribbble, which is a really good way of kind of getting a digest of just some interesting stuff that's happening.
Making it exciting for the readers. Because they keep going, and what you missed. And being aspirational for the members, right? I want to be in this, or I want to be, three-time mention on the blog. Yeah, I've been in the weekly replay three times. I'm the shit.
Yeah. Right? No, people love it. And that's the thing. I mean, I think Dribbble... That's the thing I like most about Dribbble is it's sort of exposing talent that might not have had a platform for that somewhere else. You know, like I'm discovering like artists out there that deserve a spotlight and deserve some attention because of what they're doing. And that's the thing I love most about building this thing is that it's just sort of getting connections going and getting people some exposure that they might not have had before. And the weekly replay I think is good for that. It's also good for like sort of combating the everything on Dribbble is flat and long shadows or something, you know, like, which if you pay attention to just the popular page on a particular day, that might be true, but
no, it's not true at all. It's not true at all.
So, I mean, there's just a variety of stuff being shared, just like on any social network.
You know, there was a certain point in the 50s where, like, the UFA style even influenced Disney, where you could look at Cinderella and go, like, wow, the flat 50s cartoon style that, like, his much cheaper competitors were doing influenced what the Disney studios did. And like, that's okay.
Wow.
We're always being, you know, art, you know, wasn't like there was one pop artist. Or one impressionist.
Right.
Movements happen, and they happen
for a reason. It's a movement. That's a perfect way of explaining it. Exactly. So,
but you know, now I'm regardless of what you might say, I'm looking at a Go to Hell Final by Brandon Duncan, which is certainly not in any way flat design or, you know, it's an illustration in kind of a 19th century style. Plus, it's an animated GIF. I have to say GIF. I'm sorry. I have to.
Oh, right. Oh, you're a GIF man.
I am a GIF
man. I don't judge. I don't judge at all.
It's stupid. I wish they hadn't called it GIF. I wish the people who invented it had called it GIF because that's what it looks like. Then we'd all be happy. But unfortunately, they call it. So this is like, it's like Kenneth Bowles. I wish his name was because that's how it's spelled.
Yes.
But. It's Kenneth, so I have to pronounce it. I have to pronounce it Kenneth.
It's the best. He's the best spelling of a name ever.
He has. He's like right up there with Jimi Hendrix, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine if Jimi Hendrix was spelled conventionally?
Yeah.
He wouldn't have been the same. Right. No matter how well he played and no matter his style of dress and everything else, it would have just been like Jimi Hendrix from down the block. Right?
That's right. Exactly. It's true.
Right?
Oh, you mean Jimi Hendrix, the guitar player. Right.
I meant Jimi Hendrix, the guitar player. Who were you thinking of?
Oh, no, I was just, I was like pretend having a conversation in my head, like okay. Someone that didn't know it was going
to. Okay. I missed that. I missed a step there. I'm sure it's me.
No, it's me. It's trust me.
Wow, someone made a Lou Reed pumpkin on Dribbble.
Oh, awesome. See, look at that. That's great.
Wow. I hope when I die, someone will make a thing that's on the Dribbble front page for 2 minutes.
Oh, man.
That sounds terrible. That's terrible. That's a terrible thing to say.
It's a terrible thing to say. I know. Jeffrey, my God.
I know. GitHub buttons.
More than a pumpkin. I see the pumpkin one. That's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff is great.
I think it's a real pumpkin.
I think it's absolutely a real pumpkin. You know, you can sort of see through. I always wanted to do a pumpkin like that. I had no idea how to do it. They sort of carve just the skin off it so it glows through or something. Crazy.
As Mitch Bartlett says, I can't even draw people on paper. How then? Right. Okay.
Well, maybe it's easier on pumpkin. I don't know. I've never tried it, but...
Well, man, this is just great. I could do this all day. Yeah. I know we're both busy, and you are super busy, so I want to really thank you for giving us so much of your time today. It always feels really short. I always look up, and it's like the time has elapsed somehow, which is...
Yeah. Well, absolutely. When I'm chatting with you, absolutely, the time flies. It's awesome to be... It's awesome to be on here again on your new Mule Radio home.
Where should folks look for you at Simple Bits, right? On Twitter.
Yeah, Simple Bits on Twitter and
simplebits.com.
Simplebits.com, which is dusty, but we'll probably get dusted off at some point. And then on, you know, Dribbble, Simple Bits on Dribbble. In Salem, Massachusetts. Which today's Halloween, but after today will be a nice quiet town again. And
oh yeah. You know my theory on witches. My theory is that there were women midwives and women who herbalists. Mm. Because based on the, you know, hunter gatherer gender roles, right? So women were the healers, and women were the birth helpers. And in the rise of the medieval guild system, right, like 1,000 years ago, when the first apothecaries, who were basically just herbalists also, but they, you know, they called it apothecary, and the first physicians who were, you know, mixing that stuff with leeches, they didn't want the competition. They didn't want the competition from women, so they called them witches.
Wow.
And today in Salem, as a result, you can't leave your studio because of this nuttiness, but it's all based on basically a trade unionism.
Trade unionism. I believe it. It's a good theory, actually. I don't think
there was ever an actual witch.
No, there was definitely never a witch. Absolutely not. And that's the kind of funny thing is that the town has turned into a Spookyville thing, you know, and embraced Halloween as a tourist thing. But yeah, in reality, you're right. I think I believe you, man.
Which is weird too, because like embracing the fact that you tortured these people and accused them of something.
It's kind of sad.
It's
right?
Like Auschwitz having a concentration camp day. Like, come on, celebrate!
Right. It's kind of terrible. I mean, innocent people died here, and that's. I guess that's what we're celebrating. I don't know.
Sorry, I had to.
We're ending this on a wonderful.
Why did I take it there?
I hope your next book is going to be about this theory about the witches.
Your next book is SaaS for Web Designers, and I'm really looking forward to our community digesting it and arguing about it and
everything else.
So, thank you again, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye.